From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I had a hard time making the transition because I was still used to being a reporter. In other words, you know, just get the facts and get as many as you can and try to analyze it afterwards. And that's backwards when you're a columnist. People really pick up a column not for the information but for a point of view. And it took me a year or so to get used to that. And I still tend to put too many facts in some of my columns, believe it or not, because I want to jam it in there. And you know, it's better as a columnist to craft a good memorable observation that helps to make sense out of the news than to try to bring people the news in the column, if you follow me.
Right.
Because people go to the front page of the paper or they go to the evening newscast to get the facts. Trying to follow the news these days can be like drinking out of a fire hose. You know,
right.
We've got so many media bringing you news and information all the time that people look for somebody to give them an opinion they can bounce their own opinion off of.
Clarence Page, syndicated columnist and author of Culture Warrior, published by Bolden Books. Twice a week, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Clarence Page addresses the social, economic, and political issues affecting Americans. Writing with passion and style, Page delivers lively commentary on today's pressing issues, such as crime, education, housing, hunger, and bigotry. His syndicated column is in more than 150 newspapers nationwide. Page is one of the most nationally recognized and highly regarded syndicated columnists in the country. His new book commemorates the 30th anniversary of his column's first appearance in the Chicago Tribune. It is the first such collection of his columns and a long overdue archives of his best work, covering topics such as politics, social issues, pop culture, race, family, new media, prominent figures, as well as his own personal life. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, syndicated columnist and author Clarence Page, In Black America.
I'm glad you touched on that because I'm fascinated by what has happened in terms of the advantage I've always said African Americans had by being forced, because of our condition,
right,
being forced to understand what multiculturalism means. You know,
mm-hmm.
You had to know how to be bilingual in our house. You know,
exactly.
You could talk, you could talk that talk at home, but you
I
go
understand.
Outside.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Well, hi there, Charlie. How are you today? There, how was the golf course on Sunday? You know.
Right.
All these things, and what I call racial navigators.
Mm-hmm.
You got to learn how to be a good racial navigator,
right,
in order to be successful. Today, that has become like a college degree. It's become a dividing line now between those who are making it and upwardly mobile and those who are not. And I think it's something that affects both sides. We're seeing more and more complexities to the class divide in this country.
Clarence Page started his journalism career as a freelance writer and photographer for the Middletown, Ohio Journal and the Cincinnati Enquirer. Since 1984, he has been a columnist and a member of the editorial board at the Chicago Tribune. Page worked as director of community affairs and as an on-air reporter at Chicago's CBS affiliate WBBM-TV. Prior to his television career, he held various positions in the Tribune newsroom for 11 years, including neighborhood news reporter and assistant city editor. Page has been a national broadcast mainstay for decades, delivering a sensible and balanced perspective on the McLaughlin Group, NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, NPR's Weekend Edition, MSNBC's Chris Matthews Show, and many other popular programs. His Pulitzer Prize-winning column, which is featured in over 150 newspapers, provides keen and clever insight on today's most pressing political and social issues. While Page is known for his liberal-leaning news, his readers have always appreciated his unbiased approach in directing criticism across the political spectrum to any individual or general issue deserving of examination.
I think everybody, years after high school, you wonder who made a difference in your life. And a wonderful woman named Mary Kendall, who just turned 100 here
mm-hmm.
in August. And she was the advisor to our student newspaper at the school. And she thought I showed some talent. I just started writing for the paper because I didn't have a social life, you know. It was a good way to meet girls. And she told me, you know, she put the bug in my ear, actually. And I was geared toward engineering. I wasn't thinking much about it. But then I was in high school at the time of the Kennedy assassination, Dr. King's marches, the four little girls killed in Birmingham.
Birmingham, right.
I've got relatives in Birmingham, and that really hit me. And I mean, all these things were happening around me, and I suddenly started to see the media as being a way to be where the action is, a little more exciting than Middletown, Ohio. So I have hardly looked back.
First job out of college?
Out of college was Chicago Tribune. Did I sound boring? I've had a really checkered career, but I started out at the Tribune. I got drafted, came back to the Tribune. I went to television in the 80s for about 4 years, and then I was invited back to be a columnist. And so I've been a syndicated columnist ever since the 80s. And so it's like I say, you know, in our business, journalism people back when I was coming out of school usually didn't stay the same job more than 2 or 3 years. Nowadays, youngsters have to work 2 or 3 different media jobs to make a living. But mine has been pretty straightforward.
Tell us about winning those two Pulitzers.
Well, the first one was in 1972. I first came out of school. I shared that. I was on. That was back before I became the tireless self-promoter that I am today.
Mm-hmm.
And I was worked undercover in Chicago on a vote fraud investigation during the primaries. There in March of 72, it was the year George McGovern was nominated by the Democrats, many will remember. And I learned more working as a poll watcher on the South Side at that time than I'd learned in 4 years of minoring in political science. It was really a fascinating experience, and I got a little risky for some of us there, not for me, luckily, but for some of my other colleagues in some of the precincts that didn't want any outsiders coming in. That's how well the political machine ran things there. And there were about 6 indictments that resulted from our series. So that was quite a rip-roaring way for me to get started in urban journalism. And the second one came in 89 for commentary. This was after I'd been a columnist for a few years. And I wasn't expecting to get it. I thought that Pulitzer for commentary is something that the old geezers get, you know, before,
right.
Like what I am now. But the ones who've been around for a long time. But it was an interesting year. I had some issues to write about that varied from AIDS to Louis Farrakhan to Harold Washington's what council wars, as they called it back then, in Chicago. And, of course, it was the Reagan era as well. And so I had plenty to work on back at that time. And as it happened, I happened to impress the judges enough for some reason that I got the Pulitzer that year.
I was going to ask you about some of the mayors that you have worked or reporting on and actually lived under. Does that make a big difference?
I think what makes the difference for journalists is if you happen to be in proximity to a big story and
okay.
do a good job of covering it. I mean, I call it the Dan Rather syndrome, because when I was in high school, Dan Rather was a young upstart reporter at CBS in Dallas at the time when JFK was assassinated. And he worked that story and was there to tell the world about it. And it because of his coverage of that story and the presence that he built up on the air, he leapfrogged into a heck of a career and became the principal anchor for CBS Network years later. And this happens a lot in our business when you've got a big story. And so I feel fortunate enough to have lived in interesting times, as the old proverb goes, going from the 60s to, I landed in Chicago right at a time when the first Mayor Daley was in power, and it was right after Dr. King's assassination, and just before the Weather Underground blew up, which even Weather Underground even reemerged as an issue in Barack Obama's campaign in 2008, and he was barely born then, but it's like I've been through those regimes, and of course, right through Mayor Jane Byrne, and the first one to beat the machine with the help of a blizzard back in 1979,
right.
And then Harold Washington, and so I did a introduction for another colleague's book here a couple of years ago that compared the rise of Barack Obama to the rise of Harold Washington, and it's remarkable that. Similarities, you know, particularly around the dynamics of race and all that. For those of us who were in Chicago at that time, we were very well prepared for the backlash against Barack Obama although none of us was totally prepared for the Tea Party.
I understand. I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question of you. Is there any truth with voters in Chicago votes being bought?
Well, when you say votes being bought, I think that gets exaggerated because the fact that people get what they pay for, you might say, in politics, right?
Right.
You know, I mentioned Jane Byrne. The reason why she beat the machine was because that was after the first Mayor Daley died. We had a big blizzard, and Mayor Michael Blandick, a nice man, smart mm-hmm. man, but not a good grassroots politician, did a terrible job of managing that blizzard, and we happened to have a primary 3 weeks later, and the voters voted him out, especially Black and Hispanic voters on the South Side and West Side who wound up getting stranded by the wonderful Chicago Transit Authority, they paid it back. So I came to Chicago with the idea that it was a town where people were being held hostage by this tyrannical Mayor Daley. And he could be tyrannical in his worst moments, but I was shocked to learn how many Chicagoans love Mayor Daley. And I mean loved Mayor Daley. It was like, you know, kids grow up saying, gee, when this Mayor Daley dies, who'll be the next Mayor Daley? You know, they thought that was the job description. And I think that's really what politics is about. Now we found some attempted vote fraud in the in 72. In fact, we found about 90-some-odd cases of dead people who somehow managed to vote that year. And isn't that a wonderful power of the franchise? Even the dead aren't robbed of their right to vote. But like I say, we had about half a dozen indictments came out of that series. And Chicago politics get a little bit cleaner every time something like that happens.
I know that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author Clarence Page. Mr. Page, how do you transition from being a reporter to a columnist?
Well, you know, that was a big surprise for me that the transition was as difficult as it was, because I wanted to be a columnist ever since I was in high school there with the high school newspaper. And mm-hmm. I had a column in my high school paper called Page's Page. Isn't that clever?
Right.
And that's the title of my blog now, in fact. But
right.
I spent 20 years to become an overnight success, you know, out reporting in both print and broadcast. And it was funny, after 20 years, when I got a chance to get a column, I had a hard time making the transition because I was still used to being a reporter. In other words, you know, just get the facts and get as many as you can and try to analyze it afterwards. And that's backwards when you're a columnist, because people really pick up a column not for the information but for a point of view. And it took me a year or so to get used to that. I still tend to put too many facts in some of my columns, believe it or not, because I want to jam it in there. And you know, it's better as a columnist to craft a good memorable observation that helps to make sense out of the news than to try to bring people the news in the column, if you follow me.
Right.
Because people go to the front page of the paper or they go to the evening newscast to get the facts. But, you know, trying to follow the news these days can be like drinking out of a fire hose. You know,
right.
We've got so many media bringing you news and information all the time that people look for somebody to give them an opinion they can bounce their own opinion off of. And I think that's what the importance of the columnist is, or the blogger and various other folks. But a lot of bloggers discover that being a commentator isn't quite as easy as it might seem at first.
I understand. But I really appreciate the historical perspective that you do include in the columns that you write.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, thank you, because it's important. The thing I run into is that, doggone, people don't know as much as you'd like for them to know.
You would think.
So you got to fill them in. You know, I mean, these people, my latest pet peeve, you know, the Ferguson story. You know, you got people, every day I get some email or something from somebody saying, why all this fuss about a white officer shooting a black man? What about all the black-on-black crime that goes on out there? What about Chicago, where 8-9 people got killed this weekend, blah, 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 you know? And this is something that I hear this because people hear it on Fox News or other
right.
places.
Exactly.
Because what that argument is a non-argument. It's a way of changing the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can't deal with police misconduct or racism in our law enforcement authorities. If you can't deal with it, then you change the subject and say, well, what about so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. That's a whole separate issue. And I've covered black-on-black crime a lot more than I've covered white-on-black crime over the years. But you try to get the same conservatives interested in reading about black-on-black crime.
Right.
The only time they want to do it is when it helps them to avoid talking about something else. So I have, you know, I feel like almost like a disclaimer. I got to say something about that almost every time I write about something like Ferguson. But you can't, you know, give all the background all the time on everything.
It's interesting that you said that. I read something, I think yesterday, where the governor of Louisiana basically said if minorities would act more like white people, then there wouldn't be any racism or racist.
Yeah, and what does that mean, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, well, what's interesting about the history of that is you can go back to before the Civil War and hear the same kind of arguments. And this is what really gets me. I've learned to love history just moving to Washington because there's so much of it around here. It hits you in the face all the time. And I'm appalled by how little Americans know of their own history. It's not just black history. It's everybody's history. And, in fact, a lot of the reason why people don't like Black History Month because it forces them to learn something about history.
Right.
And so I get a kick out of these people who are anti-multiculturalists. I say, no, do you even know your own culture? Let's talk about it. You know? And let's say I'm kind of straying off the point here, but you know, you look at the Confederate flag arguments and this sort of thing. I admire people who defend the Confederate flag because at least, you know, as long as they know something about the history of that flag.
Right.
But a lot of them don't know. And so it's like I have forced to myself to learn more history. And you get into it, and it's fascinating. And sometimes it's depressing because you see how often history repeats itself, whether you want it to or not.
You've recently put together a comprehensive book on your column. Why did you think at this time that you need to be retrospective and prospective at this time?
You know, earlier this year, I woke up one morning and I said, dang, I've been writing a column for 30 years. It's only coincidental that I happened to come with this revelation right after Charles Krauthammer came out with a book, a 30-year book of his columns. But I said, well, if Krauthammer can do it, so can I. And it's been fascinating, though, to go back over 30 years of columns. It can also be painful sometimes, you know, to go back over what you've already written, hope it's, you know, pushed into the past. But it's illuminating, though, to go back, because my punditry career happens to have spanned the era of Reagan to the era of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of changes have happened during that time. And I've noticed trends and ideas that will lead to future books, but I think what really is striking to me is how much race relations have in some ways been turned on their head over the last 30 years. When you go from the Reagan era to the current day, back then we were talking about the Southern strategy, for example,
right,
in which Republicans used to get the support of disenchanted white voters. And the Democrats became this party that was so full of minorities, they said, how can we get white folks back?
Mm-hmm.
And then after Barack Obama's second victory Mitt Romney's surprise defeat, in which he won blue-collar white males and almost nobody else, then suddenly people looked back and said, hey, you know, over the last six elections, Democrats have won the popular vote in five of them. And suddenly now the Southern strategy is reversed, and it's the Republicans saying, how can we get more voters of color? And and I'm telling Democrats, you know, don't be complacent about white voters, because
right,
in the post-Obama era, the dynamic is going to change again. But we're learning a lot about the nature of the country, how it has changed, and how our cultural views have changed a lot.
Over the years, how much has your perspective evolved?
Well, in surprising ways, I think what has happened is I have been, when I first started writing and reporting, and even when I was a local columnist, I didn't care much about ideology, right or left. I didn't care about who's right or who's left. I care about what works. And I've still got that basic attitude, but as a result, I've shifted on some things. For example, I initially was opposed to school vouchers,
mm-hmm,
and over time, though, I began to see a great value in choice, as long as you can do it without taking money and resources away from public schools that need them as it is. I'm finding more and more voters of color appreciating vouchers as giving them a choice that middle-income and upper-income parents already have. And so I've tried to find ways to use that, because what we really want to do is educate our kids.
Right.
It's not a question of whether or not the money comes from the state or from private people or through subsidies or foundations or whatever. We got to find, use all these resources any way we can. So I think that's made a difference. And also I've rediscovered my inner conservative. when I was in high school and Barry Goldwater ran for president, at first me and my buddies liked Goldwater. He favored ending the draft, legalizing marijuana, legalizing prostitution. I said, no, what is there for a 16-year-old boy not to like in that package, right? It sounds like party time. And then he voted against the Civil Rights Act of 64, and that was it with me and Goldwater and the Republicans. But there are a lot of Republican virtues that I feel have been lost over the years as we've gotten more polarized now. Because go back to the 60s, if it wasn't for Republicans, we wouldn't have had a Civil Rights Act. Goldwater strayed from where most Republicans were at that time. But nowadays, we've got a small group of people who still call themselves black Republicans or black conservatives, but it's very small, and half of them are in it as a business. But the sincere black Republicans I know are very frustrated right now, because they say most of the white Republican leadership doesn't want to talk about civil rights unless it's for white firefighters or something like that. And this is true. We're seeing this again with Ferguson now. They don't want to talk about black-on-black crime unless there's a white police officer accused of racism. And so it's this is the way my view has evolved over time. One of my pet causes now is to help the Republican Party to rediscover their inner Abraham Lincoln. It's been a long time.
As an African-American, Clarence, we have been taught or somewhat prodded to be multicultural, understanding the other societies. Do you believe having done that and doing that brings an added perspective to your columns?
Yeah, it does. And I'm glad you touched on that, because I'm fascinated by what has happened in terms of the advantage I've always said African-Americans had by being forced, because of our condition, being forced to understand what multiculturalism means. You had to know how to be bilingual in our house.
You could talk
you could talk that talk at home, but you go outside. Hi there, Charlie. How are you today there? How was the golf course on Sunday? All these things, and what I call racial navigators. Mm-hmm. You had to learn how to be a good racial navigator in order to be successful. Today, that has become like a college degree. It's become a dividing line now between those who are making it and upwardly mobile and those who are not. And I think it's something that affects both sides. We're seeing more and more complexities to the class divide in this country. I think multiculturalism is something that we need to seriously look at in this country and say, this is not a threat. America's always been multicultural, but it is a pathway to success, especially as America moves toward the point of not having any racial majority. About 2052 or 2042 is the latest year I've heard that there will be no single race with the majority. We already got about five states, including California, that don't have a racial majority. And does that mean, what does that mean? What it means is we all need to be more comfortable with people who don't look like us.
Besides race, what do you perceive are the other hot button topics?
Class.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I just touched on.
Right.
And class is worse than race in a lot of ways, because when it comes to people being comfortable talking about it, a lot of folks aren't comfortable with either one. But class is something, you bring up class at a party and you can clear the room pretty quick. You start talking about things like, how much do people make? How much, how much upward mobility do you have? And this kind of thing. When you look at our society today, this is, and I saw this happening in South Africa when I first was reporting from there in the mid-70s, the time of the Soweto riots. Everybody knew apartheid was on the way out. It would not actually end until after Nelson Mandela got released in 89, but everybody knew it was on its way out. It was already starting to happen. And that what was going to happen with black South Africans when they become a majority. It became really important to start building a black middle class right now, and that was something the apartheid government was very slow to do. But now they see the value of it, and they try to make up for lost time. Same thing happened here in the U.S. after the Civil Rights Acts were passed in the mid-60s. We saw from 65 to 85, the black middle class more than doubled in this country. I defy you to find any country on the planet where any group of people advanced that far that fast. But then ever since the mid-80s, we've had kind of stagnation around the poverty issue. Low-income African-American households shrunk to about 24% in the early 90s. And then it's kind of bounced back up in recent years as the economy went bad. But still, it is a divide between, as Henry Louis Gates said, it's a divide between black haves and have-nots that is bigger than the divide between blacks and whites. Meanwhile, I add parenthetically, poor white folks still outnumber poor black folks, though numerically, a fact which often gets lost in these discussions.
Mr. Page, with the 24-hour news cycle that we have, and we have social media and bloggers, are journalists losing that perspective edge where there's a race to be first instead of being correct?
You know, we were talking the same thing back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. We were having these discussions in media circles and media reviews and all that. That is it better to be first or to be right, to be correct,
exactly.
to have some depth, you know? There's nothing new about that, and there's no specific answer. It's like saying, you know, is it okay to have ice cream? Yes, but after your broccoli.
Exactly.
You know? You got to do both. And I think that what has happened now, well, for one thing, the blogging age is good in the sense that you can try to keep up with the pace of the news with the feed that you have online, feeding the news out to the public. And you can make changes, you can make corrections, and you can add depth and all. What we miss is reflection. And I was on a panel the other day with a couple of my colleagues on MSNBC, all three of Jonathan Capehart was running it, and he's a columnist of the Washington Post. And there were three others of us from around the country who were columnists, and all of us agreed that our biggest problem these days is trying to find time to reflect.
Clarence Page, syndicated columnist and author. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as your future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.